Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio on this Friday before the Memorial Day weekend. This week, President Trump unveiled his $4 trillion budget that increases military spending and makes deep cuts to entitlement programs like Medicaid. The House passed a second version of the Republican health care bill earlier this month, and that proposed around $800 billion in cuts to Medicaid. The program provides health care to the poor, elderly, and people with disabilities. Fox News' Bill Hemmer is heard here interviewing Congressman Sean Duffy earlier this month after the House passed the new health care bill.
The truth is, we all know that Obamacare is imploding. People are getting hurt. I mean, we heard in yesterday in Iowa, out of their 99 counties, 94 now won't have any coverage at all. People get hurt, and they're playing that kind of politics. I think it's disturbing, especially, Bill, when no Democrat has lifted a finger to help try to save health care. There's been no fix to Obamacare that Nancy Pelosi or Chuck Schumer have put out. So I voted for it because we have to do something. We have to help people. And so what we're trying to do is take that center out of Washington and put it back with our states and our families and help drive down the cost of care for our American people. And this is the first step. I mean, we're going to have to get to the Senate.
What do you think happens in the Senate?
Listen, Bill, judging what the Senate does is a pretty tough thing. But you know what? They're going to take it up. I hope they move fast because time is of the essence. And they're going to make changes. They're going to tweak it. They're going to put their fingerprints on it. And but I think what the positive is, though, is they're going to start with the House bill. So they're going to start with our template, and they might tweak it and modify it. Then we'll have to come back, and we'll have to work together and fix the differences. But we're on a path to making health care work again.
Charles Krauthammer thinks we're on a different path, one that could take 7 years. And the end is probably something you're not going to like. Here's what he said last night.
They have sort of accepted the fact that the electorate sees health care as not just any commodity. It's not like purchasing a steak or a car. It's something that people now have a sense a government ought to guarantee. The terms of debate are entirely on the grounds of the liberal argument that everybody ought to have.
So how do we get
Once that happens, you're going to end up with a single payer.
Well, I was going to say,
that is quite a forecast. What do you think of that, single payer,
yeah,
down the line?
Well, I hate to disagree with a good doctor, but that is not the direction we're going in. That was the direction of Obamacare. We've taken it in a new direction. I will see the point, though, Bill. You know, we are trying to help people out who are poor Americans who can't afford insurance on their own. So the government is stepping out and helping out that group. But we're trying to actually drive private markets, which is the exact opposite of single payer, in this health care package. And you saw how tough it was. I mean, even with the Republican base, you know, trying to get the conservatives and the moderates to come together and find a package that everyone could buy into, is it kind of came to that very point that Charles was making. What kind of involvement do you want government to have in health care? We navigated and the Senate will now pick it up and do what they do.
Again, that was Congressman Sean Duffy speaking with Fox News' Bill Hemmer about the Republican health care bill. Republicans in the U.S. Senate are hammering out the details on their own version of a health care bill. The cuts proposed by the House bill and President Trump are concerning for those who provide services to those most in need. Reba Rice is executive director of North Lakes Community Clinics. She sat down with me in Iron River the other day to talk about what the cuts could mean for people in northern Wisconsin.
We do know a couple of things about that probably it will change eligibility, benefits, reimbursement for providers, or increased cost sharing for patients, or any combination of those four things. All of those certainly are risks that we'll have to consider as we think about how we can continue our current programs, certainly how we can grow in the future.
So what are all the services that you offer or that people receive through Medicaid?
Sure. Well, in Wisconsin, Medicaid benefits are very rich, which has been fantastic. People can have access to medical care, they have access to dental care, behavioral health, substance use disorder, occupational therapy, physical therapy, chiropractic care. So there's a whole number of services that are available to our Medicaid patients, all of which we provide.
How many people do you serve, and what are the communities that you serve in northern Wisconsin?
We have centers in seven communities: Ashland, Washburn, Iron River, Hayward, Minong, Turtle Lake, and Balsam Lake. and we serve about 80,000, we have about 80,000 visits every year, serving about 20,000 patients.
And are the vast majority of them Medicaid recipients?
I would say probably 50% of our patients are Medicaid recipients. The rest of them are either commercially insured patients, so they've got regular insurance through their jobs or through the marketplace, or they are self-pay, and we have several lower income patients and families who are participating in our sliding fee scale program, meaning that they get their services at a very steep discount based on their income.
And you ticked off a long list of the things that you would have to consider if these cuts were to actually go through. I mean, foremost on that, would you consider eliminating programs?
We're not considering eliminating programs right now. One of the things that we're very grateful for is that community health centers, federally qualified health centers, as they're also called, have long been considered a very critical part of the safety net. And right now, everybody still believes we need a safety net. We're grateful for that. We're grateful for the faith that's being placed in us. And we do believe that, especially as these cuts come through, patients are going to need us, and so we will find a way to be here for them. Under no circumstances would we consider eliminating any services at this time.
So would this affect patients more than, or the organizations that provide services like you? I mean, is it going to mean that people might not be able to, or not might not be eligible to receive services?
That's a great question. That's our major concern about these changes, is that while it might not affect community health centers, it certainly will affect providers of primary care and specialty care of all kinds. Because if they change Medicaid benefits and so not every benefit is covered, or they change provider reimbursement so that reimbursement is even lower for providers, many providers will not be able to afford to provide that care. While community health centers may still be able to, it would be very bad to lose any of our primary care partners out in the community, and especially if you think about in our small rural communities, our critical access hospitals, which will be very negatively impacted by changes to Medicaid reimbursement. And it's not to say that federally qualified health centers wouldn't be negatively impacted by that, but we're much more concerned about the health of our community than our own self-preservation.
And you spoke about the partners that you work with. So, you know, if they were to see a lower reimbursement rate through Medicaid as a result of these proposed cuts, what would that mean for some of your patients? Would they have to, like, travel further to get access to care?
Yes, they may have to travel further. They may have to, the services that they get severely limited, for example, primary care providers could serve them in their communities, but they might not be able to go to that cardiologist or that oncologist because they might not be able to afford it, or they might not have insurance anymore. If eligibility is changed so that people with very low incomes just don't have access to affordable insurance, even if they have quote-unquote access, it's not affordable access, that's not truly access. And so if they don't have insurance, then more expensive services beyond primary care, like, for example, emergency services or specialty services, will be outside of their reach, which could have a very, very negative effect on super sick patients.
And if providers would be affected, like primary care providers that you work with were affected, would that mean that you could potentially see more people looking to you for care?
We sure could. We are the safety net. And so if patients who have been able to have free choice of a variety of different services are all forced to come to the community health center, it's not that we wouldn't welcome them with open arms and we'll have our sliding fee scale available to them. But if that is detrimental to our partners, that is very bad news for the whole community. And it's bad for employment. We'll lose jobs. We will lose professional people who have moved to the area, who bring their tax dollars and their families and all of the spending that they do to come and work in the clinics in places like Ashland or Iron River or Minong or Hayward. And we just can't afford, our healthcare system up here is not at all robust enough to afford the loss of any single one of our partners. They're all critical to the health of our community.
And the reason that you say community health centers or North Lakes Community Clinics wouldn't be as affected as much is because you receive a higher Medicaid reimbursement rate through the federal government because you are a federally qualified health center.
That's correct. We do receive that higher rate, and that's at in jeopardy for sure. So we may lose that. That higher rate pays for all of the additional services that we provide that are not reimbursable. And just an example of that, we have a program called our reentry program. We have a resource coordinator, which is like a case manager kind of person, and they go into the jails in Ashland, Bayfield, and Sawyer counties right now. Those are the three counties where we have this program. They go into the jails. They work with folks to try to set up employment, housing, community contacts, continuity of care, so that when those people are let out of jail, they have productive things to do rather than just going into the same community that might have contributed to their being in trouble in the first place. Also, we have therapists who go into the jails and provide therapy services there. We are also working to provide addiction or substance use disorder services in the jail to make sure that we are, for example, when a patient comes out of jail, if they've become sober while they're in jail, we can give them some medication-assisted treatment, like in the form of Vivitrol, so they have what's called a blockade on board. They come out, and they're not tempted to use alcohol or drugs because they don't have they already are in treatment, and they're already on their road to ongoing sobriety. Those are services that are not reimbursable. We cannot bill for those services. We do not bill for those services. So those kinds of services are the extra things that we provide because we get that cost-based reimbursement or that enhanced reimbursement from Medicaid. Those kinds of services then are in jeopardy, and those are services that save our taxpayers thousands of dollars per patient in small communities where that really matters. We spend so much money as taxpayers in Bayfield County on emergency detentions and other needless times that people are put in jail. If we can reduce that even by a couple per person, we make enormous strides towards saving the taxpayer money. And so these are just ripple effects of this change. If we make these changes to Medicaid, it's not like the money is just going to have to come from somewhere else. It's still going to come from the taxpayer because people are going to end up in emergency rooms or jails where they don't belong.
Republicans who are supporting these proposed $800 billion worth of cuts to Medicaid say that the expansion of Medicaid funding since the recession is just unsustainable. What do you say to that?
I would agree. And what that means is that we need to do some smart spending on prevention. The reason it's unsustainable is that we are not working with prevention to make people better or to keep people better. We continue to work on very late stage cures and treatments. And what we need to be doing is spending as much money as we possibly can on stemming this incredible and horrible tide of opiate use and meth use and childhood trauma that is just feeding the healthcare system thousands and thousands and thousands of new patients every year at an acute level. We need to stop that tide by getting upstream of those things. We need to stop criminalizing things like behavioral health issues and substance use disorder issues and making the criminal justice system deal with those. We need to let the healthcare system deal with those problems because that is a way less expensive way to do that. I totally agree that the Medicaid spending is unsustainable. There's no question that we could continue on this path. It's just going to take a long time for us to back out of where we've gotten ourselves. And it's going to take some very smart spending and investment in prevention.
Well, given that everything is still kind of in flux with the federal budget, how does this affect your ability to plan?
It's a great question. It makes it very difficult to plan. That being said, what we know we have to do is continue to see the patients who are coming to us. And we need to continue to work with our legislators to try to come up with really smart solutions. I feel very fortunate to live in Wisconsin and to be offering health care to people in Wisconsin because I know it's a state that really cares about its people and wants to make sure that we have as strong a safety net and as strong a social fabric as we possibly can create. And so I have a lot of confidence that we'll be able to figure it out. That being said, it doesn't change the fact that we should all be a little bit afraid of these draconian cuts that we're looking at.
And are your patients kind of voicing some of those fears as what's happening in Washington, if that's going to come down and affect them here?
Definitely. Patients are very concerned about it. And our message to them always is, together we can work it out. That's the way it's always been up here. We're not afraid of poverty. We have been living amongst it and with it forever. And so that's part of our proud tradition here in rural Wisconsin, and in particular in rural northern Wisconsin. We know how to make do with a little. And so we will figure it out together.
Is there anything I'm missing that you want to add?
Just that I hope that when one thing that I'd like to say to legislators is that people need to recognize that the impact of losing healthcare providers, losing farm support, losing educational support to rural communities disproportionately negatively affects us. Sometimes our healthcare providers here in these communities and our educational facilities like WITC or Northland College, St. Scholastica, all of the colleges that are up here, all the hospitals and the healthcare providers that are up here, we are some of the largest employers. And if our ability to expand and continue to serve people is negatively impacted, lots of people will lose their jobs. If we don't continue to support our farmers, lots of people will not have the income that they have, and we will move a whole bunch more people from independence to dependence on the social programs that we are talking about cutting. And it's our job, all of our jobs, to try to move people from dependence on those programs to independence. And I really like the message that our job is to not think about our compassion or the goodness or strength of our country based on how many people we have on programs, but how well we move people and help people and support people to be independent, which is what everybody wants to be. And I like that idea, but we need to recognize that help is a very important word there. If we shove people into independence, that doesn't actually make them independent. We can't just say, poof, now you're independent because there's no more support for you. That's just not how it works in reality. And so my fear is that in Washington, where it's possible to just with a strike of a pen talk about a million, a billion, or a trillion dollars, that there's not really the understanding of the details of what that means in rural America. And I believe that rural America will be disproportionately negatively affected by these enormous cuts.
Again, that was Reba Rice with North Lakes Community Clinics talking about proposed cuts to health care by President Trump and House Republicans. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but coming up next, we'll hear from Northland College President Mike Miller about why the school is laying off staff and cutting wages for all employees. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. This week, Northland College in Ashland announced it's laying off six staff and cutting wages to address a $3.5 million budget shortfall. The news comes as tuition costs are rising nationwide faster than income. Many families are still recovering from the recession, and there are fewer high school grads attending college, according to the National Center for Education Statistics. That means private and public universities nationwide, and particularly in the Midwest, are competing for a smaller pool of students. Northland College President Mike Miller sat down with me this week to talk about how the college arrived at its decision to make deep cuts to balance the books.
Northland has a long history of periods of time where we've struggled with either enrollment or other kinds of finances. Since the recession, it's been a challenging time for families and all of our country, and that reflects itself in enrollment trends and other kinds of things. So Northland has taken these last few years since that time to try to develop a lot of prominent academic programs and centers, and to try to expand the way that we live in the higher ed world to become increasingly attractive. And we have some very good results as a result of that, but it takes time to build back the resources and all that. So we've closed the gaps in the last years with a variety of fundraising strategies and other banking strategies, lines of credit and that kind of thing. And we're just out of options for that. And so to bolster ourselves in this time, the board made a decision to make some pretty remarkable budget cuts to come in line with our resources. And so we have gone through a process to try to identify what's least essential to the student experience, to the quality of the academic programs, the research, the outreach pieces, and we've tried to, in doing so, make some cuts that will again assure that we're around for another 125 years, and that we can weather any storm. You and your listeners obviously paying attention to what's going on in the world and the conversations of potential cuts to federal and state financial aid, and there are other things that kind of threaten the existence of our institutions. So we want to make sure that we're prepared for anything that comes, and so that's what got us here, and that's the timing and the speed with which we've had to kind of identify these cuts has been a real challenge, but the board are people who are deeply committed to Northland and felt it was absolutely necessary, so we're trying to follow through.
Well, you mentioned aid as a piece of that, and I wanted to ask you about that because I know a number of private colleges across the nation have tried to incentivize students to come to their colleges by offering lower tuition or some sort of aid to help families who may be struggling as a result of the economic recession. Did Northland's offering, you know, the same rate as like a four-year state school, was that a factor at all in as far as the financial difficulties it's facing?
I think, speaking now for all small privates, but certainly for Northland, we have had to become increasingly attractive and affordable for folks. And expenses always go up, so with inflation and other kinds of things. So, yes, we offer very lucrative financial aid programs for students. Otherwise, we can't be competitive. That becomes a real challenge because it costs a lot to run a college. We've got a lot of employees and there are educational experiences and support systems and all of those kinds of things that are also increasingly necessary to support the students that we have. Almost half of our students fit the federal definition of poverty. Are Pell eligible, and we've tried to reach out to urban learners. So we have a very successful recruiting program now for impoverished urban youth who want to be environmental leaders and ought to have that opportunity. So the fundraising piece is it's going to be much of my life, has been much of my life, to increase the aid we have for scholarships. Otherwise, it's aid that's offered from the institution, and we just don't have the money to back that. So we end up needing to do more with less.
But what I'm hearing you saying from before is that this is not just one thing. It's a combination of factors that have led to this point.
Absolutely. It's not certainly not the same thing, but I would point to countless numbers of businesses and corporations that are going through downsizing. We mentioned before the UMD and UW-Superior and WITC and all the institutions in our area are going through this kind of thing, and that's the truth nationally. Private colleges are experiencing a real downturn in enrollment and trying to figure out how to craft the right message to invite greater numbers of students back. So it's something that's pretty pervasive. And a number of the environmental schools around the country that we're associated with, places like Warren Wilson, are going through this exact same process. So it's the way of the world. We have to be proactively trying to be in a position where we don't get in even more difficulties. And certainly there are a lot of small colleges closing in the country, and we're too important to the region, and we're too important to the world, frankly, with our educational experience to let that happen.
And in order to bring your budget more in line with where you need to be, you're proposing 7.5% pay cuts for faculty and staff, and then also 10% pay cuts for vice presidents, and you yourself are taking a 12% pay cut?
Yes, and more, actually, but my concern is with the faculty and staff, and there may be opportunities to overperform in areas. Our goal is to get to this spot and hold for a year, and then be able to build back as enrollment comes and as other revenue streams. I'm put to together an invitation to faculty and staff and trustees to form a group to really look at what other models, what other strategies can we have to be sustainable. We need our best minds continuously thinking about how to do that. And again, I would just point to the numbers of ways we've enhanced our educational experience with internships, experiences, research, the centers that does important work within the region on water issues and other climate issues and societal issues, food issues. That was purposeful to try to be this wonderfully attractive, high-quality educational experience with a lot of relationship, a lot of hands-on, and a lot of personalized instruction where we can guarantee that students, when they graduate, are going to be really well-prepared to do whatever they want to.
So besides the cuts, what other changes are you making to try and position the college better?
Sure. We've been, over the last years, we've done a number of things to try to continuously adjust the finances. So we've restructured our contracts for food service and for facilities and maintenance, have other contracts we're renegotiating to be in a bit better position. For 2 years, we've had a faculty incentive for retirement. Faculty members put in a lot of years, and at the end of their career, their salaries are pretty high, and so if they're ready to retire, and then there's an incentive that we provide, and then we're able to, after they leave, fill their positions with younger faculty who want to start and but come in at a lower rate. So there are a number of those kind of pieces that we've tried to do. There are some staff cuts and some reductions. We've tried to capture as many open vacancies as we can so that we don't affect any more people's lives. We mourn that because everyone is here is wonderful and has been doing a great job, but we've needed to do that in order to get to the position where we feel like we can be sustainable.
It's not the first time that you've been through something like this.
No.
But, you know, compared to other times where you've had to make cuts or change programming and things like that, do you feel like this time you'll be better positioned coming out of it?
I think so. I think we have, because we have so many successes going on, and we've made gone to great lengths to leave those programs relatively unaffected. I mean, all faculty and staff have pay cuts, but we've tried to retain everything that is working and is successful, and still believe that we've got a lot of opportunity and a lot of things to offer students who want to come here. The college has gone through many phases, many times of cuts. Malcolm McLean was president during the 70s, a wonderful gentleman who just was an amazing president. And he and I had many conversations about a time in the 70s when they were declared exigency and were in a position to laying off tenured faculty members and things like that. And so there's been, a cycle of this, and my hope was that we would be able to have the strategies for improvement bring us along. They are, but it came along too slowly, and so we have to go through a period here of going through a couple of years of really some sacrifice in order to kind of continue to get through this.
So what do you want staff and faculty and all the employees of Northland to know? And then on the other side of that, what do you want the community to know about the changes that you're making?
Okay. Well, we've had a lot of obviously written communications and meetings, and we have more meetings coming up to help everyone understand. And what I think one core message is that we're doing this in order to get to safe harbor. We're trying to decrease our vulnerability to things that can happen to the college. The board's primary concern, and they're concerned about a lot of things, but their primary concern is that we're around for another 125 years. So survival and doing so with the strategy and the mission of the environment and sustainability is really a key for them. So we're trying to exercise make some tough decisions in order to be as sustainable as their mission needs us to be.
So if Northland continues down the path it's currently on without cuts, what would happen?
That's really probably not a certainty. Things can happen, good and bad, to institutions. But without strong options for filling gaps that happen, we might be in a position to close. I don't want to think about that, and that's so this is about becoming less vulnerable. And I would imagine every other institution, private institution, would say the same, that it's a harsh world. The conditions around us pose a lot of threats, and the worst potential is closure. And that wouldn't be good for the region or the town, and it wouldn't be good for higher education not to have a school like Northland in our particular area. And so that's the potential that we're trying to avoid at all costs.
So when will all of these changes take place?
Many things are already in place. I mentioned the last couple of years we've been putting pieces into place. There are a number of the personnel changes will happen in the next couple months. The other things come with a new fiscal budget, which is the fiscal year starts on July 1st for us. And so a number of the personnel changes and a number of the pay and other kinds of things, those pieces will come into place on July 1st.
Well, is there anything that I'm missing that you would like to add?
No, just a reminder that we care deeply about the people, and so anytime this kind of thing happens, there's a really natural and wonderful amount of caring and sadness, and none of us like what's going on around us in many respects, and so there's considerable anger. So we're doing all we can to kind of help people through that time, and want to assure folks that Northland will go forward very strongly, and we'll do whatever we can to kind of remain the institution that we are, and care for people and be engaged in the region and try to do important things.
Again, that was Northland College President Mike Miller talking about cuts to employees and changes to programming at the college. In the interest of full disclosure, listeners should know that I once worked for Northland College and managed the college's radio station, WRNC. that is set to end broadcasts as part of the changes. I also sat down with Northland Staff Council President Demri Mulliken to get her take on how staff are handling the cuts. Mulliken didn't want to say much about the changes, but she says the cuts are certainly being felt by staff.
The staff is sad about the cuts and really have are here to support each other right now and make sure that the colleagues that are no longer with us feel supported, and the staff that are here will come together to support each other and really focus on why we're here, which is the students and sending them out into the community to change the world. We all believe very strongly in what Northland College is and the education that this college provides for our students. And I feel that there is a great sense of pride in the work we do, and that is what our staff is talking about right now. We're sad, but we know that there is a purpose behind what we do.
You're listening to the song, A Highway Shall Be There, by Lowercase Noises. We're going to take a short break for these announcements. You're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. The Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa recently bought around 80 acres of land from Bayfield County. The tribe has been working with the county, state, and National Park Service to buy back lands within their reservation. Bayfield County Administrator Mark Abels-Allison spoke with me recently about the county's land sale to the tribe and the relationship between the two governments.
If I go back a little bit in the history, Bayfield County and Red Cliff have a tribal county relations committee that has met for many years. One of the topics over the past that's kind of risen to the top has been a memorandum of understanding between the county and the tribe. And one of the priorities, one of the focus areas has been lands. Bayfield County owns, 1,200 plus acres within the reservation boundaries. And one of Red Cliff's priorities, as stated in the Memorandum of Understanding, has been to have a return of some of those lands, some or all of those lands, to the tribe. So the recently approved Memorandum of Understanding was maybe the impetus or part of the justification. That, together with some supplemental funding, allowed for a transfer of this particular parcel, which was very close to the Frog Bay National Tribal Park. So it made sense to the tribe, and it worked out to both the tribe and the county. So that's kind of maybe in a nutshell how the process worked.
Okay, so it's land near the tribal national park.
That's correct.
Okay, and how much land is going to go back into the hands of the tribe then?
I think it was just under 80 acres.
But the tribe would like to see almost 1,200 acres of county land return?
Yes, they would. They are interested in the return of additional lands. This particular parcel has been discussed for, or this topic has been a discussion for some time, and the group, kind of both the county and the tribe, and the Tribal County Relations Committee, kind of went back and forth, and we thought this was a good place to start, and it worked out for both parties. There was some compensation that the county received for the land, and the county is going to take those funds and reinvest them in other lands outside of the reservation. And so the county's forestry goals are going to continue. So it's going to be a win-win, and actually the county hopefully are going to be able to leverage supplemental funds. So we'll take the funding that Redcliffe provided and be able to leverage additional funds and purchase hopefully more than the 80 acres that we sold to Redcliffe.
Okay, and so how much is the county receiving for the land?
I want to say it was $80,000. I think that was the price that we agreed upon. Forestry is very important to the county. It provides supplemental funding that funds many different projects in the county. And it's also a critical resource for towns. Towns receive funding for the county forest. They don't receive tax dollars, but they do receive 10% of stumpage. In addition to that, they receive 30 cents per acre from the state to try to make up for the non-tax status of the properties.
That was going to be my next question, is just, you know, if you have any indication of how this land sale might affect the county's timber revenues.
You know, I think this particular way we've structured this is it actually should enhance our timber revenues, because while we're selling approximately 80 acres, we're hoping that we can leverage additional acreage over and above the 80. So in the end, our acreage will be higher, which will benefit residents of the county and towns where those forest lands are.
Okay, and so you're planning to leverage funding through the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Fund?
We do have an application in place, yes.
Okay, so are there specific sites or pieces of land that you would hope to add then to the county forest through those dollars if you receive them?
I think several sites are being considered at present, but we don't have a specific one finalized.
Again, that was Bayfield County Administrator Mark Abels Allison. Up next, we hear from Redcliffe Tribal Chairman Brian Bainbridge about why buying back lands is important to the Band of Lake Superior Chippewa.
First off, we have to, I guess, have a description of the lands. As you mentioned, public lands. These lands are right smack dab in the middle of our reservation, first off. That weren't always in the ownership of the state or the county or even other private ownership. But, you know, to get to the question, why it is important, because our land base really is part of our identity. This is where we're connected. This is where we're from. You know, people. We always hear the negativity that happened before, you know, when reservations were established, and you know, we were then, you know, put in specific areas, and you know, then that's where we live, and that's why we call our reservations. But these areas were really still significant even before that, because there are areas of where our ancestors migrated to, and you know, it was where the land and water was plentiful with fish and everything else for survival. That's why these lands are important.
So when did the tribe begin buying back lands?
Well, we've been purchasing land off and on, I guess, for quite some time, not as aggressive as we are now. You know, my thought process is, you know, when we talk of repatriation, you know, it's usually artifacts that are found and identified. But, you know, we seem to forget of some of the most important things, like our land and to where we're connected. And that's where I guess my mindset is in establishing a strong land base and trying to repatriate our original land base. Again, you know, it identifies us as Red Cliff people, but it also strengthens our sovereignty. You know, without the strong land base, it really weakens your ability to govern and make decisions.
So is that kind of the driving force behind why you've become, as you said, more aggressive in looking for land right now? Or, I mean, why has it become more important in recent months?
I wouldn't say it's never been important. I guess prioritizing, putting it ahead of some of the other things, but still concentrating on everything. You know, it's just something we have to do. But, you know, we've had people that struggled. You know, I have deep in my heart, and I recognize this as the so many things that happened throughout time, and you know, a lot of it was negative when it comes to our land and our land base and how it started getting fractionated, that I think it's important to recognize that. And for our ancestors that walked before us and do something about it. I think it's giving the previous leadership that had struggled to maintain what we have today, and you know, continually tried to fight for. You know, it's important. It becomes more than just land. You know, I don't want to sound like you know, the old land barons in the way back in the day that, you know, hey, we're just going to try to gobble up land and take advantage of it and do all these different things. But it's about preservation, repatriation, thinking of as we do as next seven generations, having a firm foundation for our people moving forward. It's about maintaining our existence. You know, it's just like making sure we always have our language. We have to make sure that we always have our place.
Again, that was Red Cliff Tribal Chairman Brian Bainbridge talking about a recent land purchase from Bayfield County. The tribe also bought 33 acres of state land from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources earlier this year for $60,000. Before the sale is finalized between Red Cliff and Bayfield County, the county has to receive approval from the state to withdraw the land from under Wisconsin's Managed Forest Law program. The Wisconsin DNR says that approval was granted last week, and the sale should be completed by the end of the month. That's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. Or you can find us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/KUWSFM. Tune in Monday evening at 7 for our series of programs called Not From Around Here. UW Superior student Olivia Shalaby interviews international students about their experiences being from another country and living in the U.S. That's Monday evening at 7. You've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope to have you back with us again next Friday. Until then, have a great Memorial Day weekend.